Good morning, or I should say good afternoon at this point. Welcome. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about a case study on agile transformation, specifically how my organization, the developer division, the ones who bring you Visual Studio and Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Online, moved from being a very waterfallian organization and over a period of years moved into an agile organization. Because this is really a case study, this is not a tools talk. So just going to set up, if you want a tools talk, I've got another one coming up on Thursday where I'm going to be basically doing the inverse of this, where it's going to be 90% in the tools, showing you everything from backlog management to customization. But here, I'm not opening the product once. So if you're expecting a tools talk, this is not the talk for you. Hopefully, I'll be able to talk a little bit, and there's enough here for teams that are already doing Agile and want to learn how other teams do it and might have things they could take back to their organizations and learn from, as well as for new organizations that are looking at ways of doing Agile. Hopefully, I'll be able to address that. I'm absolutely happy to do questions throughout because I know this is kind of a hot topic where a lot of specific things for specific organizations are in mind. If you think it's something interesting for everyone, by all means, just raise your hand and I'll stop what I'm doing and we can have that conversation right away. But again, I'm also going to be at the booth and I'll be around all week. So if you want to set up a one-on-one meeting, I'm absolutely happy to give you some of my time and talk about your specific organization and the problem you guys are having and take some of our expertise and bring that along with you. So that's kind of the lay of the land for the day. I'm Justin Marks. I'm from the States, obviously. Originally from Miami, Florida, where I lived for most of my life until I came out to Seattle to work for Microsoft right out of college. I've been there 12 years now. I've met my wife in Seattle, so I'm now going to become a permanent native. My kids are being raised there. So this has really become my new home, and I think of it as home much more so than even Miami, Florida. And whenever I'm not working, I'm eating. That's basically what my lifestyle is all about, cooking, eating, enjoying good food. So I'm really enjoying my time here in Barcelona, definitely eating a lot of amazing stuff. So it's a great opportunity that Microsoft paid for me to come to Europe. Who's going to complain about that? So kind of the punchline of today's talk. Agile is a journey. It's done a lot of different ways and a lot of different teams, and it's not done in a single way by all of Microsoft. Nobody at Microsoft is 50-plus thousand employees in Redmond alone. There is not one way we do Agile. So what I'm really going to be talking about is the developer division. And in our organization, we've moved into a three-week sprint cadence. We are doing Scrum at team levels. And we are really emphasizing self-managed teams. Autonomy is something you're going to hear a lot of me repeating a lot throughout the entire talk. Giving teams the power to make the decisions for themselves and do what's right for the customer in a very, very rapid fashion instead of waiting for some pointy-haired boss or bureaucrat to make a decision for them. So we do have a top-down plan where we obviously want to think about our business case as well as what are the things we're trying to do as a larger organization. But we also want those teams to do what they think is right because they're the ones closest to the customer. So that's kind of the overall picture that we're going to talk about. So what has our journey been? For most of you, I'm assuming you've been Visual Studio customers for a long period of time and you've been with us through many, many releases. And in general, we had a release every 2 to 3 years, starting with our 2008 product and obviously many products before that. And then when we moved into the 2012 product, we started to come out with a much more regular cadence, where we started coming out with the boxed product once a year with one of our big deliverables, as well as having quarterly updates, where we would have updates beyond just what's inside of the box. In the same time, we also launched Visual Studio Online, which is our web-based presence and our service, like what Nino was talking about in his previous talk. And we've had a very, very rapid growth as well as accelerated development going from August or September of 2011 to now where we've gone from a preview mode to a live mode to a not only is it live, but we're fully extensible and having an open platform for people to be able to build on top of our platform. And that train just keeps on going. We're constantly bringing new value every 3 weeks to the service. And that's our opportunity to not just obviously monetize the product, because we are a company, we do want to make money after all, but more importantly, it's a connection with our customers, where you as a customer don't have to manage your own product, but at the same time, you also get value constantly being delivered to you. And we as a team get to see how people are reacting to that value. learn from what we've done, fix our mistakes, improve on our success, improve on our successes, et cetera. And that's been one of the big things we've gained from moving to become an agile organization. So let me kind of take you on a little journey and first tell you, what did it look like before? What was the world that I lived in as an engineer on that team? And then we'll talk about why we changed and then actually what that change really meant. So before, our life cycle was basically about 2 years. For a 2 year period, we had a pretty large upfront planning period. And at the end of the period, I, as a program manager, had written all of my specs for the rest of the 2 year product cycle. We knew exactly what we were going to build, and now it was just a matter of time before our engineers turned the crank and out popped magical code that solved world hunger. So then what we did is we handed it off to the dev team, and we said, well, we've got 2 years to ship it. Let's break it down and just ship it over the next 2 years. And we had a perfect schedule, and we knew exactly what was going to come out the other end. Sound a little familiar from other organizations, perhaps? A couple little things went along the way. Yes, we had 2 years, but the reality was all we really did for a coding perspective was about 8 or 10 weeks of coding twice. And we did that once for our first milestone because we had perfect estimates. We knew exactly what it was going to take to build it. 20 weeks is plenty to go build a 2 year product cycle. And then after we built it, we would all celebrate and have a big party because we've got to code complete. All of that code we worked so hard for was in the product. And then we'd basically spend 4 to 6 months burning down bug debt. Because what happened? Because the devs only had 2 8-week chunks to go write codes, they didn't care about quality. Well, they cared about it, but they knew, hey, we've got a whole big quality milestone that's going to be another 4 months. Let me go put as much functionality into the box as I possibly can, and I'll deal with the ramifications later. We're not shipping. I don't need it to be able to be installable. I don't need to worry about performance. I don't need to worry about stability. That's all down the road. So while this is a little funny and silly that I talk about it this way, it didn't really work well. Like, we did products like this year after year, and it worked somewhat. Windows was like that, Office was like that. It served a purpose. It was a very, I wouldn't even say modern, it was a very standard way of doing software, but it really didn't solve many of our problems. Some of the things that happened were obviously bug debt. Bug debt was a huge problem. Imagine you're a college student, just leaving university, you get hired into Microsoft, you're all excited to go build some software and have some fun and learn, and all you have to do for the next 4 to 6 months of your life is fix bugs and stuff other people wrote. Does that give you real value? Does that excite you to come to work every day? Of course not. It's really hard to attract talent, and it's really hard to have them learn and get excited about what they're doing if all they're doing is fixing a mountain of bugs. We weren't able to install our product on a regular basis, so as a developer, I couldn't actually see if things were working, and that was another level of frustration. So things like that were kind of the reason we wanted to go change, let alone the fact that, oh, by the way, the market constantly is moving, so if we know what our plans are and we wait 2 years, are we really going to be delivering the value that customers need 2 years from now? Probably not. So we took this as an opportunity to reevaluate everything we did and kind of go back to the basics and figure out what were our goals? What did we really want to go solve? Because the world was changing and life didn't just stand still. This is a perfect quote explaining why we were actually, like, the market is constantly moving. It just didn't work anymore, and we had to come up with something new. Times were changing. So what were some of the things that we actually saw in terms of times were changing here? First, market opportunities come and go pretty quickly. If we have a 2 year plan, and that plan can't deviate because that's all we're working on, we can't capitalize on new opportunities. When it came to customers, they were actually working on a multitude of new connected devices. So if we're going to be shipping a box product every 2 years, that really doesn't work for them, and they can't really use the product the way they want to use it. And also, we wanted to make sure that our enterprises stay connected to us so we know how people are using it. We know when Nino, one of our MVPs, is working with a customer and they have a problem, we actually can do something to address it, and we can reprioritize our backlog and act on it. We would never have been able to do that in our previous model. So now what do we really want to do? We measure our cycle time. We measure how long does it take to go from an idea to actually gets released into a customer's hand. And at the end of the day, that is the only metric that matters for us. We don't care about bug numbers. We don't care about load test or performance metrics. It's about how quickly can we get a product into the marketplace. And of course, built into that is quality. We can't be building up piles of debt because there isn't a milestone. We don't have a milestone quality. We don't have a sprint where all we're going to do is bug debt. All along the way, we want to make sure that we're actually taking care and making sure that the customer experience, which includes performance, it includes stability, it includes scale, is all taken into account. And that's part of the value of the feature. If it doesn't meet all of those needs, it's not a good feature because it's all part of the customer experience. So there were three kind of key goals in our transition. First, we wanted to make sure we met our customer needs. That was absolutely one of our number one things. If we're a company, we're going to be successful selling our product, we have to do right by our customers. Second, we wanted to make sure our employees were interested in being at work every day and were satisfied and wanted to keep coming back for more and not looking for other opportunities. Part of that was empowering them, giving them the ability to make those decisions that they needed so they felt like it was their product and not some other random person's product that they happen to just be a cog in the system on. And last, we wanted to be able to shift to the cloud world, and that's where Visual Studio Online first came from. So summarizing that, there was kind of six key points, and these will kind of be the guiding principles for the rest of the talk. These are the things we really cared about. We cared about staying connected with our customers. We cared about reacting to feedback. We cared about being able to plan and learn on our plans and measure our successes. These were all things that we actually took into account. So again, as I started the talk, Agile training or Agile moving to an Agile world is a journey. It did not happen overnight. For us, it took 3 years to be able to move and get the entire organization into an Agile way. And there were a lot of things that you might think of as small, but were incredibly important in terms of our transition. One of the most important things we did was we did training. We brought in best of breed Agile and Scrum trainers into our organization, and we had every single member of the team go through that training. And yeah, there's some silly little box exercises you get to do, but it gave us the sense of what does it really mean to ship software in an Agile way. And we were able to take that learning back to our teams and say, what did we like? What did we not like? What do we want to work on? What do we have to figure out? But it wasn't just us that did that training. It was our managers that did the training. We didn't want it to be an us versus them type of system. We wanted to make sure that everybody understood the expectations. Everybody had gone through this themselves. So whether it's Soma or Brian Harry or me at the very bottom of the rung, everybody knew what Agile meant and how the system would actually work. We had to rethink our entire product backlog. We had to put all of our portfolio of products. And let's be honest, there's a lot of products in the Visual Studio family, whether it be Blend or Visual Studio itself or the diagnostic tools or TFS or Visual Studio Online. We had to bring all of those things together into a single portfolio and put them in a backlog and prioritize them so we understood what actually gets done when, where are we going to spend our resources, and how are we going to actually drive that value down through the product teams. We had to build Agile teams. One of the things that's interesting about Microsoft is we're very discipline specific in terms of our organizational hierarchy. As a program manager, I report to program managers, and they report to program managers, and they report to program managers, who eventually reports up to Satya, our CEO. Teams aren't made just of program managers. I need some developers to go write my software. I need testers to validate the quality. So while our organization wasn't going to change, we had to think about our teams differently, and we had to build teams that were cross-discipline, and we couldn't just escalate whenever there was a problem, because the person you're escalating to is Satya. We had to learn how to work in a cross-discipline specific way. And lastly, we had to move from milestones to sprints. We weren't worried about six-month chunks. We were worried about three-week chunks. And we tried a bunch of different numbers, and 3 weeks for us was the magical number, and we could talk about that. But it was a very large mindset in trying to think of, what does it mean to deliver in a three-week period? How do I plan? And if I only have 3 weeks, that's not very much time at all. By the time I blink an eye, it's over. What happens if somebody goes on vacation for 3 weeks? They miss the entire sprint. What are we going to do? These are the types of things we as an organization had to go through and learn and figure out how we were going to have to handle them, because they're all important. They might be small individual problems, but all these small problems put together create a much larger set of questions that we had to go work and solve. So our big things that we wanted to get out of Agile at the end of the day were fourfold, and these were kind of our four pillars of value. First, we wanted to be able to do continuous improvement. We weren't going to be shipping every 2 years anymore. We were going to be shipping daily if we could get away with it. We wanted to make sure that we were always shippable. things like testing, things like setup, can't be deferred down the road. At any moment, we should be able to ship the product because we are shipping on a regular basis. And regular is not monthly or yearly, it's weekly. We wanted to have trust and transparency throughout the organization where I know exactly what value I'm bringing and how it fits into the whole picture, and management knows all of the work that's going on and can clearly see how people are doing. And lastly, we want to have fun. We want the people to enjoy coming to work, because when they enjoy coming to work, they're going to do their best work. And that was a big change from our Waterfallian world, where you had a big cost thing that you had to go solve, and every day was just ticking off the checklist. That wasn't the culture we wanted to build in our organization. So with that, let's start talking a little bit about all of these different things and how, and we'll go a little bit deeper level. We kind of did this at the 10,000 foot level, and now we're going to get into the nitty gritty and talk about really what we do. First, let's talk about our teams. At Microsoft, across the entire company, there are really three major disciplines. First is program managers, and that's myself. We're the people who work with our customers. We understand what our customer problems are. We translate those into specifications, and we're really responsible for figuring out the what. What is it that we're supposed to build? Why are we building this? What problems are our customers solving? Next, we have our developers, and developers are obviously the ones that write the code. They solve the how. What is the right algorithm to put in place to solve this business problem? And lastly, we have our QA, or sometimes are called SDETs. They're the quality engineers. They're the ones responsible for making sure what we ship to the customer meets the expectations and has the right level of quality. And with these three different disciplines together, that's what makes up a team. So as I mentioned earlier, PMs report to PMs and devs report to devs, et cetera. But when you think about an individual team, I've highlighted individuals. So there's generally one program manager. There's a development lead, which has 5 to 7, sometimes 8 developers working for him. And then there's one quality lead, and he has 2 to 3 engineers working for him. And together, those make up a single Agile team. Those Agile teams generally are going to work together for 12 to 18 months. We don't want to switch them too regularly, but we do kind of on a seasonal, one of our big box planning. You hear about Visual Studio Next, Dev 14. You've heard about that in the foundational session. Before we started the Dev 14 train, we reevaluated and shuffled people amongst teams because we wanted to allow people the opportunity to go try other things and take their skill sets to other teams as well as learn new skill sets. And the way we did that was actually kind of interesting. And for me, another one of the ways that we make sure people are enjoying work and having fun, we let the individuals decide what teams they were going to be on. Each of the program managers picked which area of the product they wanted to own and be responsible for. They kind of got up in front of a big room like this of all of the engineers and said, here's my 30-second pitch on what the build team is going to do or what the version team is going to do in the next 18-ish months, very high-level vision statement, not here's the nitty-gritty work items on a backlog. And we let every single IC pick which team they wanted to be on. And you know what? As everyone always says, well, how is that going to be? Everyone's going to pick their favorite team, and this team's going to be overloaded. No. It actually worked out pretty well. I think in the last one, there were 2 individuals that didn't get their top choice for which team they were going to be on, and they were more for business reasons, where there was a skill set that they had that we absolutely had to have them in a specific space. And we say, you know what? We need you to go over here for this time. We understand this is something you want to go change for your career. You want to be able to build. And we're going to make sure in this dev cycle, in this product cycle, we have the ability for you to go to the next team. And you will get your first choice above anybody else next time. But let's come up with a plan, not just for about the product, but for your career and for your skill set to be able to make sure other people have that knowledge. That's another part that we adopted from the Agile world. We wanted to have cross-breeding inside of our teams. And what's most important about these teams, they're autonomous. I own my backlog. My manager influences things, but I own my backlog. I'm the one that says, what is the version control team going to do? What is the order we're going to go execute? What problems are we solving? What are the specifications? I'm not waiting for somebody else to hand me a document saying, here, go just do this, and then I'm just somebody that just makes things happen. That's not my role. Autonomy is key to everything we're doing here. So one of the questions I get asked a lot is, who's the Scrum Master? Let's bring it back to this whole world of Agile. Well, I tried it. I was the Scrum Master a couple sprints. There was a little too much power in me for me being the Scrum Master and the product owner. That one did not work out either. We tried having the dev and the test leads do it, but they have a lot of people management responsibilities. They weren't really the right people for it either. So really what we've done is we said, who wants to be the Scrum Master? I've had teams where there's an individual on the team that wants to be the Scrum Master for many, many, many sprints. I've had teams where we rotate the Scrum Master responsibilities. In every sprint, somebody else is the Scrum Master. And we kind of have a list, we have a wiki page internally, and we say, here are all the roles and responsibilities of the Scrum Master. One of them is bringing donuts to meeting. Okay, let's rotate it through, and everybody gets to bring donuts once a month for each sprint. And we've tried to formalize that kind of stuff to make it a little more fun, let the work get spread out across the whole team, and also to make sure that we are cross-training each other and having more people learning this stuff and understanding, oh, Scrum Master has to do all this. Maybe as an individual, I want to go be a little more proactive and give this information to the Scrum Master instead of waiting for him to ask for it. Things along those lines really helped us in terms of maturing as an organization. Another thing we did is we moved physically. We used to be in offices. Microsoft is very well known for every person, one person per office. And the more senior you get in the organization, the better of an office you get, so you get a bigger window or more space. Having been there 12 years, I was at a corner office at one point. What we did is we literally tore down the walls. There was a building that, Building 18 was the first building we did this in. That's the building I'm in. And the building had basically been reclaimed. We had lived in it, we'd been in the building enough times where the depreciation value and how the real estate and facilities people measure it, we'd gotten all the value out of the building. So they said it's time to rip it down and start over. So they gutted the whole building down to the studs and they rebuilt it. But they didn't put a single office in the entire building. They built the entire building out of team rooms. And the team rooms are designed to have different sizes and different functionality. This is actually a picture of my team's team room here. There's room for 12 to 16 desks, depending on the individual room. The team rooms have their own little private phone offices. So if you want to go talk to your wife or kids during the day, you can have a private conversation in a little cubby. We have individual conference rooms and focus rooms that are different sizes and styles connected to each of our team rooms. We have larger communal areas for people to be able to talk with each other. And while I'm not suggesting everyone in this room has the funds or the ability to influence their organization to literally rip down the walls, it was definitely a really great experience. It was a very hard transition, don't get me wrong. Having to learn how to work when there's 12 other people in the room with you is difficult. As the program manager, the person that's making all of the why decisions, every single little bug, somebody was asking me, hey, Justin, do you have a second? I want to know what's your opinion about this color of red? Or does this one have the right padding? Or hey, we're thinking about doing this. Can we cut this and make this trade-off? That's kind of distracting for me doing my regular job and writing specifications and actually having customer calls and things like that. But you have to learn to adapt, and the team did. Over basically 6 months, of the first 6 months being in the building, we realized simple things like, you know what? People like listening to music. Building didn't come with headphones. Let's buy headphones for every single person in the building so they can actually focus, listen to their music, or just put their headphones on not to be bothered. Small thing, cost us $30 per head, well worth it in terms of productivity. Other people learned to adjust their schedules a little bit. Some people came in earlier, some people came in later. Again, another adjustment process, but the fact that we were in a team room significantly improved not just the communication on the team, but also the quality of the software. Because we weren't waiting for some tester to file a bug and then wait for some other person to triage it before it landed on a dev's lap. The tester would turn to his dev and say, hey, I've got a bug right here. Can you fix it? And the dev would quickly code the fix because he was already in that code base, and away we'd go. So again, another way we adjusted and we figured it out how to make it work. Oh, and by the way, it's not just the engineers that are in these team rooms. Our managers are as well. So Soma, our vice president, he's in a team room. He's in a team room with all of his direct reports, so they're able to be able to have a very clear communication. There are no offices in the building. The only time, actually I shouldn't say that. There's one person who has severe allergies, and because of that, he can't be around people because of scents, and he is in a cubby by himself. But he's the only person out of a building of 400 or 500 people that is not in the common space. Pretty cool change that we made. Yes, do we have remote employees? Another question we get. Absolutely. We have, on my team specifically, we have people in Denver, Colorado, we have people in the UK, we have people in India, we have people in North Carolina, we have people in Idaho, we have people all over the world, and we have to adapt and be able to support that. So we try to keep everybody local, but we actually do support remote teams, and tools like Skype and Link fully enable us to help ourselves out there, and we're quite used to doing that. And frankly, even though we are saying we're all together, A lot of people work from home different days. People have responsibilities with their family. Someone's sick. They just want to be able to be heads down and not have to be bothered. They work from home, and if we have an important meeting, they call into the meeting on the link call, and they listen in, and we share our screens. Again, we use technology to help solve some of those problems. So the next thing is about sprints. I mentioned before that we chose 3-week sprints. That was an interesting conversation. A lot of people say, well, why 3? Why not 2? Why not 4? Well, 4 was too long, 2 was too short. That was really the reason. We felt that we did a cost-benefit analysis of like the overhead of running a sprint every 2 weeks. While we would have liked to ship every 2 weeks, that would have been nice, but at the same time, doing sprint planning and retrospectives and things along those lines every 2 weeks, it started to feel a little daunting. So we said, let's try 3 weeks. And we didn't want to wait for 4 weeks for every month because that was just way too long to deliver software. So our sprints start like this. We have a 3-week sprint. We do planning at the beginning. When we're done, we do our retrospectives. And then the interesting thing, there's kind of this magical 4th week there in the dark blue box. That's overlapping the next sprint. That's the week of deployment. So things like integration testing and doing final validations in our pre-production environments happen there. That is absolutely an overlap. We're not saying there's a bunch of work that we're deferring in that 4th week. This is not the time to do testing. This is not the time to go fix your last minute bugs. This is the time to make sure whatever you worked on integrated with everybody else is going to continue to work and is going to be able to be deployable. The number of bugs we fix there is generally under 10, and that's across a 3,000-person organization, let's say. So we do have that 4th week, but it's purely for deployment reasons. And then at the end of that week, we deploy, and that's what you see on our hosted service. When you see, like today, where we had an announcement, hey, we're going live with our Sprint 73 deployment. That's the deployment right there. So that's our sprints. So that's kind of the logistics of the who and the when. Let's talk a little bit about communication, because I think communication is one of the most important things when you're adopting an agile way. We want to talk about communication within the team, communication going up, and also communication going out. So the first one is, how do we actually tell everybody what we're doing? We have, I guess, 20-something agile teams inside Brian Harry's organization, inside of Visual Studio Online. How do we know what's going on with all those teams, especially since we're constantly moving every 3 weeks? Well, pretty simply, we use email. Email's a great method of doing this. We don't want to set up another meeting. That would just be terrible. Who wants to be sitting in another meeting? So at the beginning of every sprint, some member of the team sends out what they call the sprint mail. And the sprint mail basically says, what is the team going to go do over the next 3 weeks? Here's our backlog. Here's a highlight of like which stories we're going to work on. Here's a quick executive summary, 4 or 5 sentence blurb, in case you're too lazy to look at all the details. And we send it out to everyone. And this is a part of that transparency thing. This is not being sent out to my managers. It's not just for the internal team. Every single member of Brian Harriot's organization gets the sprint planning mail. And then at the end of the sprint, to keep ourselves honest, and again with the transparency, we do a sprint completion mail, where we say, what did we actually accomplish? What news stories came in? What distractions were there? What live site incidents did we have? What customer calls did we have to make that we weren't planning? And we talk about exactly what we did and how we did it. And not only that, but we also give a video. And the video is probably the most important part of that entire email. It's show the value you provided in that 3-week period. I'm not talking about what you're shipping, because shipping is a completely separate thing from our 3-week sprints. And let's be really clear here. Just because we're on 3-week sprints does not mean every feature I start in a sprint must ship the last day of the sprint. Absolutely not. Some things do take multiple sprints to ship, but you're constantly providing value. You're still building on top of what you started there, and you want to be able to show that. So here are actual 2 mails I actually sent, so you can actually look word for word exactly what I'm talking about. This is my sprint plan mail. You can see I have a couple goals that are highlighted, a couple sentences at the top, and then a little table of my user stories, and below that are some funny pictures of the team. And then at the end, I've got my sprint summary mail where we basically say, okay, here's what we did, and here's a giant video. And those are kind of the key pieces there. So let's see, when I say a video, these don't have to be overly technical. This is not Hollywood-style editing. I'm not trying to go put special effects everywhere and try to improve performance by cutting down seconds and shaving things off. No, no, no. I take a 2-minute demo, and I take maybe 4 minutes to make the video. And the only reason it takes me 4 minutes is I hate doing voiceovers. I'd much rather go in there and put a little caption bubble every once in a while in the video. So as a demo, let me show you the video that I did for a while ago. Now, this feature that we did here was Git work item association. Basically, the idea is when you're doing a commit in Git, you could type #ID, and it would associate it with work item X. Nothing pretty about this. I'm just going to go into command line. And as you see, I have little bubbles that I put in using Camtasia, and I say exactly what we're doing. That's it. This is incredibly clear to every single person, no matter what context they have of what I'm providing. And on top of that, these are things we can actually start sharing with customers. We send these, some of the top videos each sprint, out to our subset of our customers and say, hey, look what's coming next. What do you think? We don't have to have other teams. If I'm trying to find out something about the new build team, I probably might have feedback about that for them. But am I really going to go take the time to go set up an environment and go figure out all of my source code that I need and build everything? No. The video allows me to see everything I need to be actually not use, but give feedback on a feature without having to do an inch of work other than pushing play. Really, really small cost for huge value in the organization. And every single one of the upper managers look at every of these videos. They know Monday through Wednesday at the beginning of the sprint, there's going to be a lot of email, and those are basically the sprint summaries from the previous week, and they respond to all of them. They give incredibly detailed feedback. I don't like this. This thing looks terrible. This is fantastic. I can't wait to get it to the customer's hand. When are we going to go do it? It doesn't matter what the feature is. We're always being able to use this as a key communication mechanism, both around the organization and up to our managers. So I'll stop that video. You can watch the rest of it. There's not much more of it, but you can watch the rest of it if you look at the slides afterward. A second one that I always get questioned is, well, what about upper management? How do they influence change here? You're talking about autonomous teams, and teams are kind of setting their own destiny. How does management steer the ship? Because that's kind of what they're paid to go do. So we had to come up with another way of doing that, and we have something called team chats. So if you think about it, every sprint 3 weeks long, we're going to go execute, and I, as a program manager, is going to make my backlog, and I'm going to share it out, and we're going to execute. So what we've done, though, is every 3 sprints, we have a big meeting, and it's basically an all-day meeting with the entire upper management chain is stuck in a room for, let's say, 6 hours. And what they do in that 6-hour period is every single feature team reporting to them comes in and gives a 15-minute presentation. And that 15-minute presentation is really there to answer 3 questions. How are you doing? Like, what's actually going on? What's next on your backlog? Do you have any debt? Is there stuff we should know about? Are you have a ton of bugs? That's unusual. Do you have some performance tests that need to be written? Are you falling behind on automation or test debt? Are there other things from training that's getting in your way that you actually have to pay down? And lastly, are you blocked? Is there any concerns? Are there any issues? It's kind of like the same type of questions you're doing in a stand-up, but kind of raised up a level. And by having this meeting every 3 sprints, it's about every 9 weeks, management gets a really good sense of what's going on across the entire organization, and they can then use this as a way to react and facilitate change. There have been times where teams are really, really behind, other teams might not be working on very high-value work, and we try to load balance those teams. There have been times where we see, oh, we have a major event coming up. We've got TechEd Europe happening, and we really want to make the 1.0 release of our REST APIs, and the build team is behind. How can we actually affect change there and influence that in the right way? It doesn't have to be a distraction every single week. We don't want the albatross coming in and pooping on our plans. Instead, we want to be able to have a more systematic way of explaining everything to management and also giving them an opportunity to react and affect our plans. Another key thing here is this is not a game of telephone. I don't tell my manager who tells his manager who tells his manager who tells Brian Harry. That's not the point here. I'm the one presenting in that meeting. I'm having direct conversation with upper management so I can tell them as truthfully as I can the good, the bad, and the ugly. This is not an opportunity to sugarcoat things. That's not the point. It's about being truthful and being transparent of what they're having. Frankly, there should be no surprises in that meeting. Everything on my backlog is very clear because they can have access to my backlog. My debt should be very clear. The issues, maybe not. Maybe they don't realize, oh, this person's going to be on vacation for a month. Oh, and this person is finding another team, and we have 2 new hires. that might actually be a distraction. We need to let them know that you might have to have different expectations of what we're going to have over the next period of weeks because we're training new people and don't have our senior engineers available. That kind of conversation happens in that room. So those things talk very much about like kind of the how you turn the crank and do work. What about the details? Where do we actually talk about design? Where do we actually get feedback on the features we're building and how they're actually going to be put into the customer's hand? That's also an incredibly important thing to do. So we have another thing that we call feature or experience reviews. So basically, let's assume for a moment that I'm working on reporting. And I want to go deliver reporting on Visual Studio Online. That's my job as a program manager. I have the vision and I have a plan to go do that. And I've spent weeks talking with my team, and we've come out with a great design, and I've got a nice PowerPoint that shows you all the pretty pictures of what it'll look like for you as a customer. I can go deliver it. I can just go start. But one of the key things, if you go back to our principles, was around transparency and feedback. I want to, before I write a line of code, I want to make sure upper management agrees with my priorities. I want to, and the team chats do help us do that. But I also want to make sure that they agree with the implementation, that they know what they're getting for the money that they're spending. So in these experience chats, I basically set up a one-hour meeting whenever I need it, and it's up to the administrative assistants to figure out the right time to get everybody in the room. And I basically sit down for an hour, and I say, this is what the team is going to go do next, and it's going to take N amount of sprints to go solve the problem, and this is the experience you'll get for investing in there. And yeah, you know what, we're not going to deliver it for a little while, but we're going to start here. Again, that goes to the, it could take multiple sprints to deliver value. So I set up one of these experience reviews. And basically there, I go through a storyboard and I talk about what we're going to build. I talk about our plan, how we're breaking up the work. Again, it is not about hours. Never in this talk will you hear us talking about how many hours it takes to do something. It's about sprints. And then lastly, I get feedback. And I get a lot of feedback in that room. I've started on slide number 2, and Brian Harry and company will completely go in another direction, and I never get to the other 35 slides in my deck because they don't agree with whatever I'm thinking. Or we go through it quickly, and everyone's like, yeah, great job, move forward. You never know what's going to happen in the experience review. I had one last Tuesday, and I thought it was an incredibly controversial topic. So I had to do a little prep meetings. I had a one-on-one with Brian and one-on-one with our director of PM and kind of prepared them for what they were going to go see, and I did my homework there. And sure enough, the experience review, boom, 30 minutes for a one-hour long meeting. Everyone got 30 minutes back on the schedule. It was great. But that's the kind of principle we're having. We want to get that feedback early. We don't want to wait till we've already started doing development and then start making changes to our design. That is incredibly disheartening to the engineers. It's incredibly costly. I'm sure none of you have been in those situations before. So, we talked a little bit about some of the logistics. Let's go back to the kind of the very beginning and talk about planning. Because one of the key things is nowhere in the Agile Manifesto does it ever say anything about you don't plan. Planning is still key. The difference, however, is we are not spending 6 weeks, 6 months of planning up front and then never alter our plans because we're too busy writing code to execute against that plan. We kind of have planning in three different phases is the way we look at it. First is our 3-week sprints. Our sprints are always planned at the beginning. That level of planning is, hey, we have these stories in our backlog. How many can we fit based on story points? The teams can go execute. We then do planning around our designs, and we execute on that, et cetera. We also have what we call our seasonal planning. So every 6 months, we as an organization sit down and we take a day, and we just did this fairly recently, and said, what are our business priorities for the next 6 months? What do we really want to go accomplish? What values or what problems are there in the marketplace that we want to go capitalize on? Are we actually doing them already? Is there something new that we should put higher on the priority list? And we use that as an opportunity to reevaluate. And then lastly, we have our vision. And that is kind of the where are we trying to go? This is used to be the large box product mentality, where over the next 18 months, over the next product cycle, we're going to go do X, Y, and Z. There's still room for that, but it's a lot more fluid than it was before. So the way this works right now is we basically have a vision spanning the next 18 months, and we literally do it seasonally. We think about spring, fall. We have a big review where we talk about what is the giant thing? And you could think of these as very, very, very high-level storyboards where we're saying there are 10 scenarios we want to go solve for the customer. DevOps would be an example of one scenario. Open platform, where we have our REST APIs and service hooks and OAuth, could be one scenario. And we basically come up with a vision deck, and that's, again, a PowerPoint. We love using PowerPoint for everything. We don't believe in Word docs anymore because no one ever reads them. So we kind of make a visual slide deck and say, here's what we want to go do over the next 18 months. And that's great. Everyone agrees with them. They're prioritized, et cetera. Then we come back, and we basically do all of our six-month planning, and that's where all the experience reviews come in. And that's really about execution. I can't really tell you what's going to happen past 6 months. I know kind of where we want to go, but who knows what's going to happen in between the two. So our sprints are all leading up to that six-month plan. And what happens when we're finished those six-month plan? Well, we cycle, rinse, repeat. We do another six-month planning exercise. After we evaluate a whole bunch of questions, we want to make sure, what did we learn? Were there things that we thought were easy that were really hard? Were there things that were really hard that we thought were easy? What can we actually do to improve ourselves? We look at what is new from the customer base. Who's saying that, you know what, reporting is our number one scenario that we must go, and they're just sick and tired. They won't come into Visual Studio Online until they get reporting. And also, we also look at the marketplace. What are our competitors doing? What's going on with other things in the marketplace that might be affecting change? What's happening around Microsoft? Now we're one Microsoft. Is there stuff from the Office team that they're asking us for? Or are there things we need to go talk to the SharePoint team and get them to deliver value for us? Things along those lines.
They don't overlap?
So they do overlap. So what we do basically at that point is we just do it all over again. Yes, we have that 18-month vision, but it's kind of a rolling window. Now that we've done a six-month plan, we say, all right, let's come up with another six-month plan, and the 18 months is now 18 months from now. So we might reevaluate those scenario reviews, and some might get thrown out, some might get edited, some new ones might be added. But it's a constant rolling window as opposed to a stake in the ground saying 18 months from now we'll actually put our heads back on and think again. No, we're constantly iterating and improving over time. So going forward with this, again, with one of the questions, one of the things I've gotten when I've given this talk is, what do we track? What does management really care about during those 3 weeks? And what do I as a team member actually use as a leader on my team? What do we use to measure? And a lot of people say, oh, well, let's look at the burn down. The burn down is the best thing that ever happened. It's the perfect chart for every Agile team. No, I never look at my burn down. There's nothing to really change there. Oh, we worked a little faster than we thought we would. We worked a little slower. Estimates are inherently bad. This is not the metric that we're looking for. This is not the thing we want to measure. Similarly, we're also not measuring number of bugs, because frankly, we shouldn't have debt. So we had to rethink about the way we actually what we actually measure and how we actually improve. So some of the things we actually do, we look at the number of bugs, but it's not at the pure number of bugs, it's the, are you allowing debt to collect, or are you doing your job and making sure debt is constantly at a very low rate? We look at our unit test coverage. We very much have been making a strong effort not to go fully test-driven, like the TDD world. We're not quite there yet. It's a nice ideal way where we'd like to get to. But we do want there to be high levels of unit test coverage. The unit test coverage, the more unit test coverage we have, the less functional testing we have to write, and the less chance there is for regression for us. We also look at our what we call the rolling build quality. We have a constant build running every single check-in. We want to know how many times do devs break the build. And every time there's a build break, we have a quick analysis. Was that done because of a tooling problem? Was it done because people didn't understand the process? Was it because someone did just something really stupid and they checked in bad code? And we kind of bucketize that, and that's another metric we use to improve our organization. And last is the dev cycle time. How long does it take for a dev to start coding to actually being able to check in? And the reason we're asking that is, what did we actually need to fix in our engineering system? Engineering system is debt. Engineering system is cost we need to pay down. We shouldn't be allowing terrible engineering systems to block us from doing good work. We want to make sure we pay for that and we put that on the backlog, and that's a priority just like everything else. So we care a lot about what does it take for our day-to-day engineers to do their jobs. Things we do not watch. We don't look at the burn downs. We don't look at the number of story points per sprint. Who cares? And you can't, it's apples to oranges. My team has 32 and your team has 26. Who's better? I don't know. We don't care about estimates. We do not have an original estimate field and a completed work field. And we're not asking devs to put in magical numbers every single day to burn down their hours. Hours do not matter to us. We can't affect change there. People are always going to put in poor hours, and frankly, no one wants to do this work anyway, so why bother trying? We also don't really look at capacity. People go on vacation? Good. Let them go on vacation. We want them to have work-life balance. It just might mean we slow down a little bit. And then, when everyone's back, we'll speed up a little bit. These are all ebbs and flows of doing business. It's not going to change the way we plan. It's not going to change the value we deliver. And also, we don't do any of those magical QA-style number of bugs found, percent resolved as fix versus won't fix. Testers are there to test the product. We're not trying to make them play games to figure out how they should be measured in the real world and which tester is better than this one based on who had a higher fix rate because somebody came in at 6 in the morning versus coming in at 7 in the morning and found more bugs than somebody else. That is not the point of it. We want to make sure the quality is high, and we don't want to have the wrong metrics to influence the team in the incorrect way. So some of the ways we do manage quality, this is kind of a picture of the way bugs used to look. In the old terrible world where we'd have these giant number of bugs and then go have to burn them down slowly. Instead, we're kind of going this kind of really simple ebbs and flows over time. So I think right now my team has, it's the worst I've ever seen my team, and my team was at 70 bugs, and I expect them to go down to 20 by the end of the week because 50 of the bugs were very, very small fit and finish bugs that we found during the last couple of days when they implemented a new piece of UI feature. Like, that's the kind of bug. Like, 20 is kind of that magical number. The reason I think 20 is because we should be able to easily fix 20 bugs within a week. And as long as we can fix it within a week, we're golden. So bugs are not something we really care that much about. We do care about bug cap. It's a kind of a math equation we have. Yep. Sorry, I couldn't hear that. Great question. So the question is, like, do we still record bugs? And what metrics do we use about those bugs to actually validate what they're about? We absolutely record bugs. And it's a fun argument that we have quite often. We were doing what we call a bug bash this past week in my team. We had implemented a new feature. And before we check it in for everyone, we basically set up a box and said, hey, take 10 minutes for everybody on the team and just go bash it and give your feedback. And the dev didn't want there to be filed bugs because it was too much overhead to go track and close them all down. And the QA team was like, absolutely, every little fit and finish thing should be a bug because I want to be able to resolve and make sure that the things did actually get fixed. That's the right answer. Just because it's a little overhead to close a bug, oh well. We want to make sure that if we find an issue, we have a way of making sure it actually got fixed. And the only way we've come up with that's successful is to file a bug. I want to be honest. Filing a bug does not take much time. Resolving a bug in a check-in does not take much time. The tools are there to do the right thing for you. So the more bugs, the merrier. One of the reasons not to do it is this whole bug game math, which how many bugs were found? That's the reason I was saying we're at 70 right now instead of being at the 20. It's because we filed a slew of bugs during that bug bash. That's okay. So we have a little spike on our trend chart, and it goes away in another couple days. Now, if you stay up there at the 70 bugs, then you're probably doing something wrong as a team, and you're letting debt accumulate. And then we could have a different conversation in those feature chats. So bugs are definitely something we care about, but we care about them a little bit differently than we did before. Another thing we cared about is we talked a lot about, hey, features take multiple sprints to go ship. Does that mean you don't check them in? No. You need to check them in as soon as they're done. Why? Because you're building up cost. You're building up debt to go check them in. And as soon as you start putting another branch and start checking in there, it starts to drift from the real code base. And now you have a whole bunch of extra work that provides zero value just to reverse integrate that work back into the main branch. We don't want to do that. So what we did is we had to come up with a solution. How do we have a single code base that's going to ship on a regular basis but not have certain features built in or not having features turned on? So we invented feature flags, which is basically a simple database call. But developers, the very first line of code when they're going to work on a new feature, they check in, and it's basically an if statement. If this feature flag is enabled, show the feature. If it's not, pretend it didn't exist and hide the code. So just one giant, you can think of it as one giant if statement around all of the new functionality. And then we have a way, because we're an online service, I could turn that on for everybody, which is how we turn the feature on when it's actually getting deployed. I can actually turn it on for an individual user. I could turn it on for an individual account. and we've built the infrastructure. It took us a couple sprints for a team to go build that. It's engineering work, but it allowed us to have very, very fine-grained control. It's not going as far as doing A-B testing. That's not the goal of this. There's a lot of value in A-B testing, but our primary goal was allow the engineering team to be fluid and to keep on working without getting stopped because of silly things like the date something gets shipped and it's not even involving them. So that's another thing that we did. One of the other things which I can never stop talking about is we do install and upgrade every single sprint. If a dev can't install the product, how will our customer? Very, very simple thought. No one should be arguing with that one. But if you look at the old world never cared less about this. Oh, we had a setup team. The setup team will get all that stuff working at a later date. We're not shipping. What does it matter? Like, no, I need to be able to install that every single day to make sure the right quality is happening and I can build a clean environment. So we've made sure there's the right engineering practices, the right training, et cetera, to make sure that can happen. So setup is not something we wait till the end for. It is a part of every feature. Feedback. Feedback, feedback, feedback. This is kind of our existence now. This is how we do our work. This is what it's all about. We want to make sure things are working well and we're meeting customer expectations. If we're not, we don't have a product. Plain and simple. In the old world, I would write software. I think it was the greatest thing ever. I would talk to a focus group. They would give me some feedback on it. So, good, I did my due diligence. Let's build it. We build it. We ship it. There's a bug. Oh, I'm sorry, wait 2 years for another product to come out for me to fix the bug. Right. That was the extent of feedback was. Oh, beta? Oh yeah, beta is a great solution. You have 3 weeks after the beta launches before the final product goes, and how much are you really going to fix there? Right. You're busy trying to do everything else. That's not the way we want to look at it. Now that we ship every 3 weeks, it is a constant stream of feedback, and we get feedback from every place we possibly can. We have a really strong site on user voice that we have publicly accessible. So anybody that doesn't like the color red we use on the homepage, you go put it up on user voice. If you really think Git is a feature we need to build, which you resoundingly said we needed to go put Git or DVCS functionality into the product, that came from user voice. The fact that you want a checkbox as a feature field for work item tracking, we know that's one of our top requests on user voice. It is a place that all program managers and all the engineers in the team are looking at constantly to get feedback of, what are we missing? What features are people asking for? We're very, very clear in Brian Harry's blog that we care about feedback, and we get a lot of feedback from that every time he gives an announcement that we have a new feature coming out. And Brian's on top of that, where every single time somebody sends a feedback, he gets some PM on the hook to go respond to that. And it's my job to go actually appease the customer and tell them what's the plan to fix their problem. We have a strong community of champs, which are kind of the industry consultants in every country around the world, and we bring them to Microsoft twice a year to basically give us very, very raw feedback. They know exactly what you're seeing because you're paying for them to see it. So we actually bring them in and they're giving us, it's a very strong relationship. It's very, very open and honest. Hopefully it's respectful at times, but at other times we come to blows because it's painful hearing some of the stuff they have to say. But if they're saying it, our customers are saying it. So we really value their feedback. And then at the end of the day, we have simple things like our Connect program where you as a customer can file bugs. So there's lots of different avenues of feedback. We've started to use social media more and more and more for feedback. So Twitter's been a great place. And every time, I know there was one of the features I built was the homepage. That was a feature I built probably a year ago at this point. I completely redesigned the homepage for the actual product. And there was a tweet that somebody thought the colors were too Christmassy. I wasn't quite sure what that meant, but you know what? The next day I changed the colors on the homepage. Like little pieces of feedback like that, I can actually do something about very, very quickly. So we love this new world because we're able to get feedback. And of course, we still do all the old world style where we have usability studies and we do customer demos and things like that. We get a lot of that feedback, too, before we build things. But we do feedback on our designs, we do feedback on our priorities, we do feedback on the product. Anywhere we can, we do feedback now. And it just makes the product better, so why not doing it? It's worth the cost. We actually do post all of our new features on the website, so we're very transparent with our customer base every 3 weeks as Visual Studio Online updates. We do a pretty good job, I think, of showing you what these new features are. as well as saying when those features will be in the box product, if and when. Things like online build stuff doesn't really make sense for the box product. That's okay. So we do our job there in terms of letting customers know. And that also gives us another avenue of feedback, because you better believe people have a lot to say about what's coming up next. Another thing, yeah. So the question is, whose job is it to do setup every sprint? We have one engineer who's the subject matter expert. Matt Hoover is the developer in North Carolina that knows everything there is to know about setup. So he's a great consultant, but it is my job to do the setup for my feature. So we don't defer it. We don't say there's a setup team. Every team owns their own setup offering. Now, yes, when you talk about a product like Visual Studio, there is one team that owns the overall architecture for the setup interfaces, for the setup code, the setup as a feature. But every team has to be integrating their features into setup so they get installed, so they can be updated, sprint to sprint, deployment to deployment.
So is that like a DevOps engineer?
Is it DevOps engineer? No, it's just a dev. The reality is every dev is a DevOps engineer, so there's no difference there. Actually, I haven't talked at all about DevOps in the slides, so at the end we'll come back and we'll talk a little about how we do operations, because that's one thing. I think I should add that into the slide deck, because it's a pretty interesting talking point. How am I doing on time? Oh, I'm good. So we'll have time to talk about DevOps too. So another thing we talked about measurements of how we actually measure the team. How do we measure the product? How do we know we're doing well? How do we measure this feedback? Because metrics are incredibly important to us. The Lean Startup, it's a great book that kind of changed the way we do business. At the time we were doing Agile, we looked at that, and the concept of build, measure, learn became kind of our internal mantra of wanting to make sure that we built software, we measure the success of it, we learn about what it is, and cycle, rinse, repeat. So we have a lot of internal metrics. We have these types of charts posted all over the hallways to let us know the health of our organization. We also not only do show health metrics here, but we also show feature usage metrics. So every time I'm building a feature, one of the first things I have to put into my spec, aside from the design itself, is what are my hypotheses? What are the things I expect from this feature? How do I know that the feature is going to be successful? And I have to have the dev team put that code in, and we have infrastructure to go do that. And then we put together a dashboard page to say, hey, everyone in the organization, let's be transparent. How is our feature being used? Is the feature performant? Is it being used by customers? What type of customers? Let's slice and dice that against size of teams. Do they use work item tracking or not? Are they paying for the feature? And we're able to do a lot of digging into that data to understand a lot more about how the feature is being used. So this is more of a proactive form of feedback that we have as well. And actually, it's changed a lot about the way we do things. When will this be on-premise version? That's a great question. I don't know when this will be on-premise. Right now, we have a very large infrastructure that's cloud-only right now, but we've definitely heard customers wanting the ability to see that for their own data.
Otherwise, we have to develop it ourselves.
Exactly. Otherwise, you have to develop yourselves. No, we totally, totally hear that. The plan I've heard, and there was no dates on it yet, we want to first be able to give our customers in Visual Studio Online access to their own data, and then we'll worry about on-prem afterwards.
But it's...
I know. I'm not trying to say that on-site's going to go away anytime. It's more of a technology thing, because right now it is a cloud technology that we're using, and we don't have an on-premise parallel, which is just part of the frustration. If you look at App Analytics, our App Insights, I should say, this is built on top of that, and that is cloud only. So we need to come up with a solution, and it might be a hybrid solution. So we're definitely aware of that. So this is a big way that we actually do things. So let me give you an example of how we use this data to actually affect change in the product. So one of the things we really care about is something called the conversion funnel, where basically we have people do a multi-step process to actually do work inside of Visual Studio Online. And the first step of the process is sign up for an account. And as soon as you type in justinmarks.visualstudio.com and they say, yep, that one's available, click give it to me, what's the next thing you have to do? Well, the next thing you have to do is create a project. What value is there in Visual Studio Online before you've created a project? Does anybody know? Is there anything you can do in Visual Studio Online before you actually create that first project? No. The only thing you can do is create a project. So the second step in our conversion funnel of getting users useful is to create the project. And once they've created the project, we want people to use build, check in code, create work items, etc. But one of the things we were noticing is there was a huge drop-off from the time somebody would create an account till they actually created the project. Actually, it was only 30% of customers were actually going ahead and creating that project. And we were like, well, that doesn't really make any sense. The only hypothesis we can come up from was either A, it was too hard to create a project, B, people didn't know they needed to go create the project, or C, all they were doing is just storing a vanity URL in case somebody, no other Justin Marks can go get it. Those were the only things we could think about. So how do we go solve that? Well, the vanity URL we can't really do anything about. We can let marketing send emails and empower people to go forward. But the first two we could probably do something about. So we said, well, this UI here, which basically has these two big, ugly blue and orange buttons, is not really friendly, it's not really approachable, it doesn't really have a strong call to action. Why do I click? I have three buttons to click? Which one am I supposed to click? What does it do? Why? Oh, it brings up a dialogue when you click those buttons. That's really bad. So we said, all right, we can do better. We want that number from 30% to go up a lot higher. So it was actually on my job to go as part of redesigning the homepage. We said, well, what can we do here? Well, if they have to fill out a form, why not put the form right on the page? Why not give them one less click to go do and actually give them something that's in their face and says, go do this? So we actually did that. We changed the page. We put that everything in the dialogue. The only thing that's required that isn't pre-filled in for you is the name of the project. We could have done that, but it would probably been, our view was it was more work for you to delete the name than it is for you to create your own. And lo and behold, what happened to the number? Well, it went up to 50%. Much better number than our 30%. Very simple metric to track. This dev work was day or two of a dev's time to go change the way this worked, and we suddenly had half of our customers coming through. Now, I'm not saying we're done. Now, there's obviously more work we can do, but we can go build more hypotheses. We can go put more telemetry into the product to understand why people are doing this and actually talk to customers more. And that's one of the things we're doing. We're emailing customers now and saying, hey, we noticed you got, like the marketing team sends email. We noticed you signed up for an account and haven't created a project yet. Can you tell us why? And we're able to get that qualitative feedback as well as the quantitative feedback and marry the two together to make parts of our project plan. So this is another place that we're doing of using numbers as well as the feedback to be able to effect change and improve our product. So that's kind of the summary of where I was at with all of my slides. Some of the big takeaways here is this was central to the way we changed our business. This allowed us to do so much more, whether it be able to deliver in the cloud way and deliver more value. Telemetry is really helping us change our product for the better. We believe the feedback is actually helping us make a better product and reach you where you're at and actually do you justice. We are using our own tools. We are dog fooding every single thing we build, which is not uncommon for Microsoft products. But we're building Visual Studio Online with Visual Studio Online now. We're not using our on-premise product and then doing it separately. We treat them as equal citizens, and we're using both at this point. We're now able to respond to our feedback a lot faster. And frankly, we've seen a much higher retention rate of our employees because they are much happier to deal with all of this stuff. And they also see when there are problems, they're empowered to go fix it. If I think there's something wrong with the build system, like one of the things we found out recently is, why isn't it when a developer who breaks the build, why doesn't he get an email saying he broke the build? Why does he have to go to a web page and go look at some information to figure that out? Pretty simple thing for a developer to go right in our system. He did that and suddenly we're able to be able to fix those type of things. Was that on anyone's backlog before? Probably not. Was it any team's job to go do that? No. We're empowering all the people to do the right thing for the system, and we're allowing them to go bring information onto the team's backlogs when they see fit, whether it be for customer features or whether it be for our engineering principles. So this was very much a process talk. I have another talk on Thursday at noon. That's going to be kind of the opposite. I'll spend about 10% on duplicate slides from here, and then the other 90% on, let me show you how we use our product. And I'll go over everything about backlog management, boards, charting, reporting, you name it, I cover it, as well as customization. So if you're interested on how our tools actually do the stuff I talked about, that's a great talk. There's also a whole bunch of labs downstairs on every single topic in Visual Studio Online. I'll be at the booth right after this. So if you have questions, feel free to come over there and talk to me. I started this talk with a bunch of videos. If you saw those, there's a kind of like a marketing version of what I've talked about here, and you can hear right from our upper management on why we changed. And they're actually pretty interesting videos. They take about 15 minutes to run through, so I have a link here to our engineering stories, which goes over our agile transformation in kind of a Hollywood-style production quality. There are other track resources. There's all the stuff they force you to put in here. Lots of really good stuff, blah, 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 blah. More resources, more resources, more resources. Evaluate the session. Sorry? So evaluate the session. It helps me come back for more because I want to go to the next city in Europe whenever we have our next conference. So hopefully you give good, bad, and ugly feedback there. I'm Justin Marks. Feel free to email me. I'm on Twitter as well. If you have questions, I love talking about this topic, so I'm happy to talk offline about individual companies and your problems and getting my advice, and you can take my advice and do what you want with it. So with that, I'll open it up to questions. There's a mic in the middle there, and otherwise you can just shout them out and I'll just repeat them. So.
You talked about distributed teams. How do you manage it? Elaborate, if you can elaborate about
it. Sure. So how do we manage distributed teams? It is interesting. So we have, there are three core teams inside of Visual Studio Online. We have a team in IDC in India, in Hyderabad, India. We have a team in North Carolina, and we have a team in Redmond. Finding a time when all three of those teams can meet is somewhat of a nightmare. Somebody always is out of luck. It's just the reality. I know that if I have to work with the India team, the two best times are either 10 o'clock at night, my time, or 7 in the morning, my time. I am an early morning guy. I've got two little kids at home. They're up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I have no problem having a 7 o'clock meeting. It just means that the people in India have to stay up a little bit later. So it's a balance. And we just have to, knowing that we work in this way, knowing that we have a distributed team, we're cognizant of it. We make sure that if we're going to have meetings, we have a very strict agenda, and we stick to the time that we need to be there, and there's a reason. We don't want to be setting up meetings just to chat. We've gotten much better at email. We've learned to be able to share more. We were able to send slide decks and send longer, not longer, but more in-depth, detailed emails. There have been times where we've had to partner on features. Recently, one of the features that is getting announced, you'll see it, I'll announce it now, but you'll see it tomorrow, this next week, is we have lightweight charting in the product. So you can take work item charts and see them over time. One of the features we're about to release in this next deployment is test case charting. So you can see test case over time and their pass-fail rate. Same infrastructure, my team owns the infrastructure, the other team did the implementation of test charting. We actually had our dev switch his time zones for a period of a couple days, and he stayed up. He didn't come to work during the day, he slept during the day, and he at night met with them and did pair programming with them until they were able to move forward on their own, and it took him 2 days, and everything went back to normal. And it turned out that time was hugely valuable because it wasn't an us versus them thing. It felt like we're together. So using ideas like pair programming, even if there are time zone issues, does really help because it builds that bond between the people and that you have that trust issue. I'm not saying it's easy. It's a lot easier for us with the North Carolina team because it's only a 3-hour time difference from Seattle. But you got to find something that works there. For the individuals that are remote, Peter Provost, who's here, is talking. He's a manager in the Application Insights team. He's located in Colorado. His entire team, dev, test, PM, everybody, are in Redmond. He has a Skype station. He literally has a monitor on a set of wheels in a team room, and he is on it all the time. So if you want to go talk to Peter, you literally go into the team room and look at the monitor, and he's there. I don't even have to go get in the middle. It's silly, but it actually does work, and he feels like he's a part of the team. Actually, MSR, was Microsoft Research, was doing some work on telecommuting and this kind of work, and they invented kind of like a robot version where not only is it a monitor on wheels, but it also has a remote control so you can turn it. And we got them to give us one of those temporarily, and we use it. It was creepy. Like, he could move the thing around, and like when he's talking, he looks over at you, and then he comes back. Like, he was like physically there. Just not a very good little splotchy quality of it. But anyways, you got to find things that work. And a part of that is being open, like having the open communication of what's frustrating, what's good. My only advice is, and I was talking to Claude about this last night because he works with the India team, plan on having like an hour after the meeting to be able to calm down before going to bed. A 10:30 meeting, you're not going to sleep at 10:31. You need some time to like let that stuff go, and we again have to be respectful of that, which is why we try to make them earlier. So, I think there's another question. Yeah.
I was wondering, how do you manage the, I guess, dependency between two
In the planet. So the question is really about the interdependence between teams. It's a great question. It's something we deal with. Every team deals with every sprint because while we try to isolate, like the version control team owns version control, the reporting teams own reporting, et cetera. We're a big system. The customers don't care about the reporting versus version control. They look at it as one big entity. So we want to make sure the product represents the entire product as a whole. So it's incredibly important to us. There's little answers in the tooling space where you could talk about things like we have linkages between work items. You could say what the predecessor and successor is. So we can track the dependency from a work item perspective. But that's a tooling answer, so you can actually track it and having traceability. But that's not really the real answer. The real answer is around interpersonal awareness there and being able to have that conversation about with other people. And as I was talking about with that, doing things like pair programming, working together on a common goal, having a single thing where both teams are working together instead of here's my piece and here's your piece. No one cares about the pieces. They care about the scenario. So first, the most important thing we do is we agree on a scenario. What are we trying to do? Do we both agree it's important? And is it the most important thing that we're both working on? If it is, then we can get into an execution conversation about how we're going to do it. Are we going to wait for our APIs to come up in sprint one and then our UI in sprint two? Are we going to, in the first day of the sprint, implement some interfaces and then work in parallel so both teams can work? We have to figure out what the right thing is. The latter is the better option. It's no different. I mean, you can take the exact same conversation and just change it from two different teams to a single team with dev and test. How is the tester team going to test while it's being developed? Well, you need to figure out. We don't want to say, okay, well, I built it in sprint one and then I tested in sprint two. That's waterfall. Just waterfall in the small, not in the large. So we try to come up with ways like doing things like build the interface on day one. You don't have to plumb it through. Just build the scaffolding so that everybody can rely on that and work together on it. And part of that is you need to spend a little bit of design time together working on, let's agree to what our interface is going to be. And once we do that and we see where that line is and we have a clear distinction between the two teams, then we can both go work in parallel. And then we make sure that from a testing perspective, we have not just my tests and your tests, we have the integration end-to-end tests. Same, whether it's an individual feature team or a cross-feature team, it's no different. Planning, it's purely a matter of priority. You have to get it to be at the same point on the backlog for both teams. And some of that is about what we do in the feature chats. We know that we're going to be building feature X in the next 3 weeks. Oh, I have some dependency on the team that's doing this. I don't see it on their backlog. Now we can have a conversation. Or, oh, I know you were depending on me. I can actually go put it on my backlog, and I know that if I build it, you're going to use it effectively soon. What we don't want is the old world way, which was, let me build my backlog, and I'm going to take every request, and I'm going to go implement all of them, and then who knows when other people are going to use it? Who knows if it even provides the value? Maybe plans change. Like, you don't want to do it that way. You want to work more in lockstep. If it's off by a sprint or two, that's okay. But if it's 3 months, I'm going to make something ahead of time for you, that's a complete waste of time because who knows what's going to happen 3 months from now. So we've completely moved away from that type of planning. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So from the planning perspective, if there are dependencies between the teams and want to move a feature, how can you measure the impact of such a change?
So first, what do you mean by move a feature?
I won't be able to,
change on the backlog priority?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the impact? Something else was more important. Impact to whom? These are the kind of questions we have. Like it's hard to give a generic answer to it because if the thing you have to kind of believe, the truth that you have to put into this is if you as a feature team are deprioritizing something in favor of something else, the other something else must be higher priority. So what does it matter what the impact of it is? We are always working on the most important thing. We'll get to the other thing when we get to it, but if everyone in the organization is working on the most important priority, everything should be good. So now, there's the question of, is my priorities the same as your priorities? And that's what we have those feature chats I was talking about to kind of level set and make sure that we're all on the same page. If you're working on stuff that is really important to you, but it's kind of scenario number 10 or 11 on the list, your team probably should be doing something else because we're not on prime. We have to do numbers 1 through 9. Those are the key thing. Until we get those, why are we talking about number 10? So now, of course, let's get into reality. There's subject matter experts. There's other external dependencies. you have to work through those things. But the reality is, at some point, you've got to make a decision, what is important? And if it's important, we work on it. And if it's not important, we don't work on it. And you've got to make those hard cuts. So. So the question is, in the organizational model, where's release planners? And actually, I'll expand on that a little bit and talk about a bunch of different disciplines. So release management, we have two release managers, and they're in the PM discipline. And their job is basically to beat the drums, talk about what's going out, what's not, communicate that out, manage the release management part to the customers, manage the deployment, all of those type of things. They don't have any engineering responsibilities. They're really our communication experts. And we actually originally had one and found out there was a lot more than just one could handle, just because even simple things like managing those feature chats, making sure upper management's on the same page of what all the feature teams are doing, things like that, that's their responsibility. So we have individuals that are part of the PM discipline, but that's their responsibility. They don't own the team, they own the release of the product. We do have architects in our organization. There are very few of them. Right now, for all of VSO, there's a single architect. And his responsibility is to make sure there's architectural purity in terms of the way we build things from our platform. So he's kind of a adjunct manager for the dev team. Whenever we do large dev initiatives, you can think of we do what we call a dev plan review, where the dev manager responsible for that feature will come and present to the rest of the dev team to get feedback before we build. Just because it's not a visual feature doesn't mean you don't get feedback on it. We do feedback everywhere. And he kind of leads that effort to make sure, hey, we're setting the bar high. A great example of that was our REST APIs. There are many ways you can go build a REST API. He came up with what does REST APIs mean to Visual Studio Online? He built out all the documentation. He validated that against the Azure organization to why are our APIs the same or different? Are we doing OData? Are we doing REST? Yada, yada, yada. And he actually brings that value. So he definitely brings value from that perspective, but he also is separate. He's just in the dev team. Another one somebody asked about was the DevOps. And DevOps is, again, another important thing. Every single developer is on call. We have a rotation for who's on call for the moment things go down. Somebody's on call. Their number one priority is to triage the problem and figure out where the problem is. And that's easy enough to do as a rotating capability, because you should know, as a developer, you should understand the system and be able to say, oh, work item tracking is the one that's busted, or this is busted. But once he does that, then he knows to be able to call the expert in a specific area. And they're able to then take the ball and actually do more. And frankly, a lot of other devs just jump on the call, not to speak, they put themselves on mute, because we do set up a bridge and we have link, et cetera. But they just want to learn, and it's another growth opportunity. And then there's, of course, a retrospective afterwards that everyone gets access to learn. But we do have specific operations engineers whose job is the day-to-day live site management. So they're the ones that are the first line of defense. They are a 24/7 organization. They're the ones doing the deployments themselves. They're the ones that are getting the calls in the middle of the night and actually or getting the alerts and say, hey, is this something worth calling, or I have a troubleshooting guide, et cetera. So, all right, so I'm being cut off here because I think there's another talk in here. I'll stay over here if you want to talk, or of course in the booth. So thank you very much for coming today.